Good evening. Welcome to the New York Society Library. I'm Sarah Holliday, Head of Events. As we begin, may I point out that the entirety of the First World War was conducted sans cell phones. Please silence yours for the duration of the event. We appreciate it. Our friends from the Corner Bookstore have copies of The Ambulance Drivers for sale in the Peluso Family Exhibition Gallery, and just saying, it's not too early to think about holiday gifts. Your history buff friends. It's my pleasure to welcome James McGrath Morris back to our lectern tonight. His past books include the New York Times bestseller Eye on the Struggle, Ethel Payne, the First Lady of the Black Press, which won the Benjamin Hooks National Book Prize. He lectured here in 2010 on Pulitzer, A Life in Politics, Print and Power, which the Wall Street Journal called one of the 5 best books on American moguls, and Booklist named one of that year's best biographies. He also writes Kindle singles on historical topics like Emma Goldman and the plot to kill Henry Clay Frick, and I'm glad I learned about those while I read this introduction. That sounds great. I better go check that out. The Economist says that The Ambulance Drivers is as readable as a novel, while The Washington Post describes it as trim and absorbing. Mr. Morris was one of the founders of Biographers International Organization and its former president. He's a true master of contemporary biography, and we're fortunate to have him with us tonight. Please join me in welcoming James McGrath Morris.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure and an honor to be here. I'm just checking out the electrical cords before I get electrocuted here. A pleasure because this organization has given tremendous support to Biographers International Organization. We've had events here, and that kind of support is deeply gratifying for those of us who are interested in biography. Secondly, it's an honor because if you open up the acknowledgement of many of the best books that come out, in the back there's always a thanks to this library. So it's an honor and a little bit terrifying to be speaking here. Anyway, as you all know, a century ago this year, the United States joined the Great War. But the Great War had been underway since 1914. And for young people at that time, the Great War was beginning to, because of its new nature, I mean, the first mechanized war, endless slaughter. And, you know, I have to preface this. I taught high school for 10 years, and one of the things I found among younger folks is that the two wars were identical except separated by different numbers. And as you well know, they were vastly different. World War II ended totalitarianism, ended the Holocaust, liberated Europe. World War I, or the Great War, was much more brought about by a kind of spider web of treaties that brought this needless slaughter to a whole generation of kids. So for younger people in the United States, like some of the characters in my book, the Great War seemed like the defining moment of that generation, much as if you move forward, the Vietnam War might have been the defining movement for my generation. By that, you know, sometimes we think of 9/11 or Kennedy's assassination, but these were one moment things. You couldn't very well rush to Dallas to experience it or come to New York. I mean, people in New York obviously would be quick, but it's a very transient moment, whereas a war going on for years meant you had choices to make. And for a lot of the young folks, like in my book, the choices involved their reaction. Would you join the military? Would you go there, et cetera? And for some of them, a very unusual operation began to surface in Europe that would attract these folks. And namely, what had happened is, as the war broke out, Americans in Paris got whatever contrivance they could and went to the French front, and brought back wounded soldiers to the American hospital. This grew to the point that there was fundraising and recruiting going on in the United States. In this image, you see the poets even got into the act of raising money, and they had a special ambulance in Italy named after the poets, et cetera. Now, these ambulances were in a variety of contrivances. As you can see, this one, as the men are looking at the wheel, were rather difficult to operate. Ford and Fiats were the most common used ones. Of course, we all learned rapidly that Ford stands for fix or repair daily, and Fiat meant fix it all the time. These were not easy contrivances, nor were they easy to drive, and I'll tell you a little bit more about them. But here are some images of these kinds of things that were rushing off to the front. Now, there's a tremendous book called Gentlemen Volunteers. You may well, I didn't check the catalog to see if it's in your collection, but it's a wonderful book about the people who showed up to volunteer. And if you look at just, this was just a few of them that I grabbed and put up there. E. Cummings, Malcolm Cowley, even Ray Kroc with McDonald's Fortune. And I looked at this list and I said, aha, this is the secret of success for in the 20th century, become an ambulance driver. My wife, who has a PhD, explained to me that's not quite how research works. What I discovered is kind of the opposite. In order to be an ambulance driver, there were a number of things you needed. First, you needed to know how to drive a vehicle. And in 1914 and 15, the only kids or young people who could drive vehicles were the well-to-do. Most folks did not have access to cars. And when I say drive, you'll hear about how hard these ambulances are to drive. Secondly, you might need money, because as a volunteer, the only way you're going to get to Europe is to pay your own passage, you need to buy your own uniform, etc. And third, if you're going to land in France, it might be a good idea to speak French. Yeah. I have just described kids at Harvard, Princeton, and Yale, etc. So in many ways, the people, with the exception of Ernest Hemingway, these were kids who were already guaranteed a success in life, born to wealthy families, well-educated, with means to pursue their dreams. But two of them caught my attention. Ernest Hemingway and John Dos Passos were among these many ambulance drivers. And as I began to do my research, I found that they had actually met during the Great War, and then got together many years later. And as I began to dig, and I'll tell you the story tonight, I discovered there was a lot more to their friendship than just a mere friendship bound together by war. The first fellow I wanted to introduce to you, because a lot of people have forgotten, is John Dos Passos. This is his graduation picture at Harvard. If I brought you his prep school picture, you would understand why prep school was very hard for him. He would have been considered a very nerdy. He was bullied. He was not a sporting man, and so prep school was tough for him. But life had been rather hard for him to start with. He was the product of a married New York attorney who had had a relationship with a widow in Chicago named Madison. And so he was born in those terms in those days, out of wedlock. The polite term would have been illegitimate. I don't use that in the book, and the less polite term shows up in quotes when Hemingway gets mad at him. But he had a childhood raised mostly in European hotels, because at that time, that was the only place his dad and mom could meet without causing questions about their relationship. Mrs. Dos Passos dies, and Mr. Dos Passos is able to marry Mrs. Madison, and that's when his name is changed. So when he's a teenager, he assumes the new name Dos Passos. Harvard offered him something tremendous that changed his life. It was, yes, the reserve of mostly well-to-do kids, but it was also a meritocracy, intellectual meritocracy, where a kid like Dos Passos could shine. And he did really well, and he loved writing and reading. He became friends with E. Cummings, who was already using his initials. He was deeply influenced by John Reed, who had graduated a little earlier than he had. And he just, it was his coming out, in a sense, in the world. He also became a left-wing pacifist. So when he was confronted with the idea of the war, like others in his generation, he felt to miss the war, to not be there, would be to miss the central defining moment of his generation. But he didn't want to go and fight. He didn't want to go to Canada and join the forces, because he certainly didn't want to fight for these imperialist powers that he didn't like. So he joined the ambulance corps. I love this picture because it looks so much like a communist apparatus as opposed to a Red Cross volunteer. I don't know. I can only surmise he had some influence on how the uniform was selected, but he got it in Paris. Here's a Bailey becoming more like it in the field. Dos Passos really was driven to go there. In his diary at one point, he says something when he's confined. His father won't let him leave the country, and he has to wait a year. He said, I really wanted to see the world, and by the world, I meant the war. Well, he certainly got an introduction to it. He was taken up to Verdun in 1917. Verdun in 1916 had seen the worst possible fighting. 17 was still no picnic. It was the same kind of useless fighting where the boys were told to get out of the trenches, move forward, and then get a few more yards of this blood-soaked soil. So, when Dos Passos got there, a couple things he noticed. The first that he noticed is that pulling up his ambulance behind the lines, he wrote that he felt very much like he was a scavenger crow. And why was that? Because as the ambulance corps pulled up, all these ambulances behind the lines, what these kids, and I say kids, remember these are 18, 19, 20-year-old people in the trenches, would look back and see them, they would know very well that within a few hours or a day, they would be ordered to stand up, come out of the safety, if you want to call it safety, the trenches, and march forward. So it was an awkward position for him. And I want to share with you his first sense of seeing the war. So this is a description of after he writes in his diary about scavenger crows, and this is how I portrayed it. More nimble than the heavy Fiats, the Fords with their four-cylinder water-cooled engines could hit 45 miles an hour on a good road. Not that they would get much of a chance to do that. Since the rains had returned, it was an enormous challenge to merely navigate the water-soaked, putty-colored roads. Pitted with shell holes, the roads were nicknamed the Dip of Death, or Dead Man's Land. At night, the ambulance ran with the headlights turned off lest they become a target. To find their way through the darkness, Dos Passos and his other assistant would either perch on the front fender or walk ahead with a white handkerchief draped from an epaulette. Now, driving these things also required another skill. I describe it as a kind of macabre, deadly dodgeball, in that when the shells land, what they would do is they would count out how long it was before the next one would be launched, because you get used to the rhythm. You know that it takes so many seconds to reload a hot gun. So as soon as an explosive landed, they knew how fast they could move to the next place. But they were waiting for these things to drop on them. The ambulance drivers were no more safe than others. Also, as they drove these ambulance drivers back, imagine they're loaded with wounded soldiers. So every dip, every bump, they would hear groans and pain and screams. I mean, this is a guy who wanted to be a poet coming out of Harvard, now in Verdun 6 months later doing this. And then there was the gas. Thicker than air, it clung to the grounds like fog. The smell of death changed to the bittersweet smell of mustard gas. This said Lawson, who was one of his friends driving another ambulance nearby. On the first night, the front Dos Passos saw green-colored wraiths of gas curling like serpents above the blackened battlefield soil. On some runs, the remaining presence of gas was so strong that Dos Passos and Marshall, that's the co-driver he has with him, got out of the ambulance every few miles to vomit in the roadside ditch. The horses pulling French 75mm field guns heaved and gasped, their eyes bulging and their nostrils squirting blood. I shall never forget, he wrote after one such run, the frightened eyes of the horses choking on gas, standing beside their overturned gun carriages, waiting for the shell that will finish them. That night, Dos Passos wrote to Rummy, this very dear friend of his, that he could not imagine a more hellish experience. So that was Dos Passos' introduction to war. It wasn't the end of it. He later, for instance, is assigned to carry buckets of arms and limbs from operating rooms out. And I'm sorry, I'm not trying to, you know, get you to lose your dinner. I just want you to understand what a transition this was for a pacifist poet arriving on the front lines. Now, our friend Ernest Hemingway had a very different experience. Hemingway is younger than Dos Passos, did not go off to college. His college was going off to the Kansas City Star. You may wonder how a kid out of high school got a job on a paper as big as the Kansas City Star. All of the 1918 young men were being drafted, so these papers were desperate for anyone who could write a complete sentence. Hemingway was already a good writer. So he went through there, and he joined the ambulance corps much with the same motivation as Dos Passos. If you read his letters to his sister, he just says, it's not glory I'm seeking, I just don't think I could get through this without having seen it. I cannot go on to my life without having at least witnessed this event. So he goes to Italy, and here he is posing in his ambulance. There's some evidence he probably never drove one, and part of the reason is that ambulance driving was not just simply a gas pedal and a brake. It took a lot of weeks of training. The pedals looked like an organ. You had a whole variety of pedals, not just a gas and brake and clutch. You also had devices to reduce the spark, to adjust the spark, it was a very complicated vehicle to drive. But Hemingway certainly collected pictures like that. Now, When he gets to Italy, something happens that I want to share with you to give you a sense of the contrast between these two men and what happens to Hemingway when he gets there. A munitions factory near Milan had blown up. Now, this is not a picture of the munitions factory, but the reason I share it with you is notice it's all women. The munition factories were staffed by women while the men went off to war. And women were regarded, of course, in that period in a very different way, so any horrific thing that occurred to them for a man was doubly horrific. And what happened was the 35 or 40 women were killed when the munitions factory exploded. So Hemingway and his partner are assigned to go and deal with it, to get the corpses, etc. The men fanned out to collect the bodies and search for human remains. The teenaged Hemingway, who until this moment in his life had only seen corpses in the manner of birds and small animals he shot in Michigan, faced carnage like that from a Francisco de Goya depiction of war. Arms, legs, backs, torsos, heads, bits of hair clung to the barbed wire fences surrounding the place. Hemingway and Milford Baker, another Red Cross volunteer, grabbed a stretcher and made their way to the wall of human fragments. The first thing the two men saw was a headless and legless body of a woman. "Hemi and I nearly passed out cold," said Baker, but gritted our teeth and laid the thing out on the stretcher. When they got back to Milan in the late evening, the other Red Cross men immediately besieged them. Like adolescent males basking in the glow of their lost virginity, Baker and Hemingway savored the moment. They were the envy of the group. "Having a wonderful time," Hemingway scribbled on a postcard with three exclamation marks to his friends at the Kansas City Star. "Had my first baptism fire on the first day here when an entire munitions plant exploded. I go to the front tomorrow. Oh boy, I'm glad I am in it." A very different perspective from the kid there. Dos Passos Ambulance Corps disbands because when the United States enters the war, the volunteer ambulance corps is taken over by the military. And so Dos Passos ends up signing up for another volunteer shift in Italy. And this is a picture of him on the far right, well, the far left, sorry, at the review of the ambulance corps. And this brings about an occasion where Hemingway and Dos Passos meet. Now, the classic thing people always ask me is, do they say to each other, "Oh, you're Dos Passos, Hemingway"? No, these are two kids meeting in a mess hall. But later, they'll reconstruct it and know they've met. And this will be important for a variety of reasons. So Hemingway begins his turn at the front, and here he is on a bicycle. He was assigned to take bicycle out to the front and bring chocolate and cigarettes to the Italian soldiers. Now keep in mind, this may seem like light duty. It's dangerous. You're going out into the trenches. And secondly, for these kids who are stuck in trenches dealing with trench foot and all these nightmares, a piece of chocolate and cigarette is a well, you know, something you'd really cherish. And they call them, what, they're American, they were very endeared to him. So one night he goes out, and there's shelling going on. And if you know A Farewell to Arms, is something people misunderstand from the Farewell to Arms passage, which is very similar to what happens to him that night, which is when shells go through the air, they go through the air at high speed. So they make a sound, and you can kind of, in a sense, track them. You know whether they're going to fall near you. Mortars have a very different deadly trajectory. What happens is when you drop the mortar in the tube and the explosive goes off, it goes, and then there's silence because it travels so slowly. And it goes up in a very high arc with the idea that it should come down vertically into the trench, and thus the walls would capture the explosive and make it reverberate in such a way to be deadlier. So on that night, there were those sounds. And then at one moment, one of them landed right in front of Hemingway. Separating him from the explosion was an Italian soldier who lost his life, was blown apart. Hemingway took in all of these bits of shrapnel. I always have to look at the book, 267, 276, I don't know what the final count was, and is severely wounded. Now, I like the fact I spoke about Pulitzer here because a point I made then about history I want to make here, a little aside. When I was researching Pulitzer, one of the things I found that was common in the newspapers of the 19th century is they would describe a fire, which was frequent in New York, and they would say such and such family escaped, but three Irish maids perished, with no mention of who these people were, just Irish maids. Well, the same thing here has happened. There's a monument to Hemingway on the Piave River that says the famous writer was wounded here. But no one has bothered to find out the name of the soldier whose death made possible the life of one of 20th century's greatest writers. So the closest I've come is in the back of the book. There's 18 names of Italian soldiers who died that night along the Piave River right around there. And I always say this at public events in the hopes that some graduate student quickly gets a grant and goes to Rome to dig up who it is. So if it happens in the next few years, you open up the newspaper and there's a little tiny box on there, name of man, Italian soldier, made Hemingway's life possible, identified. Know that it started as an appendix in this book. So Hemingway is wounded and he ends up in the hospital. Now, I've talked to a fair number of Afghanistan and Iraqi American veterans about this. And I'm not trying to diminish his wounds. Very serious. He's not life-threatening, but he's got all this shrapnel, and it's a very painful thing. But for a lot of veterans, this is like winning a macabre lottery, in that if you're going to go to war and you're going to come back, coming back wounded in such a way that's not a disability, you know, not losing your leg or something serious like that, gives you a kind of special cachet. And in many ways, this is something that's going to be important to forming Hemingway's personality. He survives the war, and he literally is going to bring it back with him because some of his bits of shrapnel will remain with him. But something else happens to him at the hospital, namely Nurse Van Kurowski. Agnes Van Kurowski is about 7 years older than Hemingway. She is a duplicate of Katie Smith, the girlfriend that he had hoped to have in Upper Michigan. Whether they actually became boyfriend and girlfriend, we don't know, but she's clearly the prototype for Hadley, Pauline, all of these people. So the first woman that does, in a documented fashion, love him, and they have these terrific letters if you haven't read them. So here he is in the hospital, and he's going to return to the United States, betrothed to her, and she jilts him famously. But why this is important is that what I discovered is that these two young men, who both wanted to be writers, have fundamentally different experiences about the war that shaped their vision of the war. Dos Passos, the pacifist, believes that war is this atrocity caused by humans that could be stopped. So he wants to use his writing to end the war. Karl Marx, whom he certainly read, famously said, you know, philosophers have hitherto interpreted the world, the point is to change it. Dos Passos wanted to channel his writing ability to bring an end to war. Hemingway, on the other side, sees war as inevitability. It tests your manliness, hence the glory of the wound, and most importantly, it brings you love. So when he comes back to the United States, this is a shot of Hemingway in Michigan. Notice he's holding a gun. Ambulance drivers did not pack heat. He begins something that's almost an osmotic version of a man he certainly knew about, which was Theodore Roosevelt. When Roosevelt began to rise up in the United States, when he went up San Juan Hill, what did he make sure came with him? The press. He's in many ways our first media candidate of the 20th century. I'm not saying that Hemingway thought this through, but that was a model for him. So when he gets off the ship here in New York, coming back from Italy, and the Evening World, Pulitzer's Afternoon Paper, and other papers interview him, he makes no effort to correct the enhancement of what had happened to him. When he gets back to Michigan, Chicago, and he speaks at the high school, and they talk about how they put cigarette filters in his wounds to stop the bleeding, he makes no effort to correct that. He brings his bloody shirt to events. And the reason I think he's doing this is he began to understand the sense of a public personality, which is going to serve him really well as a writer. If you look later, after my book ends in the 30s, but you look at his work with Esquire and other things, he's creating this character that's much like a fictional character to support his fiction. Of course, like many novelists, the distinction between real and fake life is blurred, real life and fiction life is blurred for him. So in 1924, 6 years after the war, John Dos Passos and Ernest Hemingway are reunited in Paris, and they regularly meet at the Closerie de Lille, a famous cafe, which is still there, and it's filled with American tourists trying to drink absinthe and write like they did. Now, for those of you who've seen Woody Allen's movie, Midnight in Paris, which is a terrific film, I love it, I do need to tell you a little bit more about the real reason Americans were there. One of the reasons that Americans were in Paris at that point is it was a destitute city. The dollar bought you unbelievable life. So for very few dollars, you could get yourself an apartment, a maid, you could spend your day in a cafe drinking. I mean, life was really good. And speaking of drinking, of course, you could drink in public, because in the United States we'd locked up drinking in speakeasies. And lastly, I've always tried to find a way to explain this, but French women were, should we say, more adventuresome than American women at that point for a young male. So Paris was kind of slumming for a lot of these folks. Yes, the creative juices were going and they were hanging out with each other, but if you read some of the French diaries, it's a very different version. There's a fair amount of resentment among the waitstaff to these Americans throwing their money around. But anyway, when Hemingway and Dos Passos met there, Dos Passos had published Free Soldiers. So this is 1924. Dos Passos, by this point, had a best-selling book in the United States, contract for many other books. The handsome man across the table that attracted everybody's eyes, because he really was a hunk, I mean, there's no question about it, had not yet published anything. He was living off his stringing that he was doing for the Toronto Star and Hadley's trust fund. Now, he's clearly talented. Other writers in Paris knew that. But the tables at this point were very different. Dos Passos' book, which had been widely reviewed in the United States, was considered by many to be virtually treasonous. In fact, a couple of reviewers said had it been published during the war, he would have been locked up under the sedition acts that Congress had passed at that point. It's a brutal portrayal of the war, modeled on his first novel, One Man's Initiation, that 64 copies were sold, and Dos Passos said, "I knew 24 of the people who bought it." Two stories let you know if your first book doesn't do well, don't despair. This book had done very well, and it represented that notion that Dos Passos had, whereas Hemingway was embarking on a very different thing. But before he did, Hemingway loved, for instance, Spain. So he immediately said to Dos Passos in 24, "Let's head off to Spain." Now, one of the problems that creates a little friction between these two men is Hemingway liked to possess things to be his. A little awkward that Dos Passos had been going to Spain for years and knew more about Spain at this point than Hemingway. So they went in the summer of 24. This is actually a watercolor done by Dos Passos. He's the one falling down. Hemingway is the one looking very brave in front of the bulls. This is a precursor to the summer in which Hemingway in 25 goes to Pamplona with a different crew, and from that Sun Also Rises comes out of it. But these two men are hanging out all the time in places. This is in Austria with the Murphys. Murphys, you know, are benefactors of many artists in Europe. When I first began research on this book, I always thought little of them, in the sense I thought they were like many Americans with considerable fortune, Mark Frost's fortune is what they had, who were, I don't know, I just handing out money. I came to realize they were really sensitive, interesting people who had more tragedy in their life than anyone deserved. They lost two of their children. And if you've never read it, you should read Fitzgerald's letter to them on losing their second child. One of the things Fitzgerald does that shows his heart is he, you know, saying Dos Passos wanted to use his writing to end war, Fitzgerald very tenderly writes, using all of the skills he can, as a salve to the awful things that happened to them. Here they are skiing in Austria. Dos Passos is the second man over here. If he looks awkward on skis, trust me, he was. The only way he could stop was to sit down, and he made a hole in his pants. This was a constant thing. Hemingway was very athletic, and Dos Passos was not, and Hemingway would constantly push him to engage in these things, such as fishing. I mean, there he is. This is Key West. Again, a little bit of a problem. Hemingway discovered Key West thanks to Dos Passos. He discovered him in part because of this novel. After the Sun Also Rises, was published, Hemingway became persona non grata in Paris because the characters he used in this book were so thinly veiled that everybody knew who they were. I mean, the hair cuts, the accents, everything was in there except the names. In fact, the names have been in there. If you look at the early manuscript, Dos Passos' name shows up in there, Fitzgerald's name shows up in there. Dos Passos' girlfriend, Crystal, shows up in the final version without her name. But nonetheless, staying in Paris was not going to be a thing. Now, one of the things I suggest to you, if you're now getting interested in Hemingway again, it's very hard to do this, but is to read The Sun Also Rises in a way as if you're reading it for the first time. And the reason I say that is that if you enjoy Garrison Keillor as I do, you know the character Guy Noir, the detective. And there's always a line,
She walked into the office and her jeans were so tight I could read the date on the quarters in her pocket. That's exactly the way Chandler wrote, but we made a joke out of it. And now we have a Hemingway competition, you know, to imitate Hemingway's first lines of his novels. You have to kind of shed all of that and reread parts of this book aloud to see how dramatically different it was from, for instance, Willa Cather, who has an exhibit here, or Edith Wharton's Age of Innocence. Those two, and this is where the friendship of Hemingway and Dos Passos takes a literary bend. Edith Wharton and Willa Cather felt the Great War had so fractured Europe, they lamented the loss of the old world order that they liked. I live in New Mexico and everybody buys Death Comes for the Archbishop, which is often seen as a Southwestern novel. It is not. It's a novel about a French archbishop trying to build a cathedral to extend the old order that she thought was so destructively swept away by the Great War. Edith Wharton has the same compulsion, whereas Hemingway and Dos Passos believe that all of the means of expression that had sufficed before were gone. Just like the composers of that time who felt writing the same kinds of bits of music would work, or the painters who were fracturing things into new forms of cubism. All of these creative people felt the war was such a demarcation, such a change, that nothing would suffice. And The Sun Also Rises is one of the first versions of that, along with Three Soldiers. And then if you look carefully at their language, they're doing things that nobody else had done before. But Hemingway, and this is a 21st century term of 20th, had still, in a sense, not processed what happened during the war. Sun Also Rises' only war reference, in a sense, is that the protagonist is wounded in a certain place in a certain way, which is indistinct and drives high school boys nuts because it's not clear as to what happened to him. But that's the war injury. This is the book where he really begins to talk about the war. Farewell to Arms features what? A wounded Red Cross volunteer who falls in love. I mean, all of these things happen. And this is, yes, the cover. But remember, Mark Twain said only a fool doesn't judge a book by its cover. When a publishing house is trying to represent the book, there are no tanks, there are no guns here. Look at the image that's done. And same for the movie. The sense that out of this war comes love is not an accident for Hemingway. This is an important component. And if you move the reel forward, of course, in the Spanish-American War, he's hanging out with Martha Gellhorn. World War II, he meets his fourth wife. I mean, war and love are very, very tightly put together for him. Meanwhile, Dos Passos is back in the States, campaigning for all his left-wing causes. Then here he is in Boston, trying to free Sacco and Vanzetti from their execution. And he's deeply disillusioned by his friend Hemingway and Edmund Wilson and others because he says, come to Boston. Look, anybody who had a heart at this point knew that Sacco and Vanzetti weren't guilty. This is not the Rosenbergs where you could debate endlessly about any evidence. I mean, these men were not the bank robbers. But nonetheless, and Wilson and Hemingway both spurned Dos Passos, and he felt very frustrated. But he was at work on this, the three volumes of the USA trilogy, which today is an impenetrably thick and impenetrably hard book to read. It still shows up on academics' lists of the 100 most significant books of the 20th century. So people after my lectures rush to the corner bookstore and pick it up, and then they go, it's like walking into a brick wall. So I have a different way of trying to explain the significance of this book, which is that if you go to a museum and you see a Salvador Dali painting, for instance, and you say, oh my goodness, I've never seen anything like this, and it's disturbing, but it's great, it's inspired genius work. Well, USA is very much like that, in the sense you might not want it above your sofa at home, but if you were to open it up and look at it, again, you have to go in time travel to understand what was being written at the time. Again, turn to Edith Wharton, for instance, or Fitzgerald, even, who had not been, by the way, to the war. He'd only been to boot camp. There are sentences in there that I could put on a multiple choice test and kids would think it's Hemingway. There's the use of trying to bring in newsreel actualities into the text. There's the introduction of real biography into a novel. There's the use of jump cut. Now, jump cut in film was so disturbing that audiences sometimes felt a little seasick. Remember, our films have had this very literal continuity. And now they were using jump cut to go back and forth and do all these things. That's what Dos Passos was daringly trying to do. And he's rewarded greatly in a minute. But another thing happens to Dos Passos and their friendship. In the late 1920s at Key West, he meets this woman, Kate Smith, the woman who had been the perfect woman for Hemingway in Michigan. The woman who had introduced Hemingway to Hadley, since he couldn't have Smith, she gave him Hadley. The woman who also knew Pauline, comes to Key West and falls madly in love with Dos Passos. So we now have all kinds of issues, but we also have the issue of his best friend marrying the woman of his dreams. But it was a really wonderful true love, in the sense that here's Dos Passos in Provincetown, and I know a picture, he could have been grinning in the previous picture, but this, if you read their correspondence, they're best friends, they're madly in love with each other. All kinds of things occur that make it a really perfect partnership. But Hemingway is not necessarily pleased, and he really gets ticked. Because Time magazine puts Dos Passos on the cover of Time magazine long before Hemingway earns his turn on the cover of Time magazine. And what they're saying is that Dos Passos is engaged in writing the great American novel. I mean, they're just clear about it. They're covering it like a sporting event. Meanwhile, Hemingway's Sun Also Rises, which was highly regarded for its language but thought of as being, you know, a portrayal of drunken, useless people, and Farewell to Arms have been a success and critically quite acclaimed. Nothing had happened since then. He published a book about bullfighting, which the critics just tore apart. Now, you may think, well, wait a second. Hemingway writes anything he wants, it's like writing a check. And that's true. He was making money like no other writer could at that time. But what he was not getting was the critical praise that Dos Passos were getting. And if you ever meet a writer and they say envy has nothing to do with this business, that's one of the biggest lies they come up with. We're all envious of each other's success. So this begins to poison the relationship, but also notice when Hemingway finally gets on the cover of Time magazine, it says, a sporting dilettante, which is a little bit of bad karma coming back to haunt him, because this is the image he cultivated, truly. But the point was that Hemingway was getting frustrated that his best friend's work, which he felt no one was reading, was being taken seriously, and his was not, which everybody was reading, but not the critics. But they depended on each other in such a way. I mean, Hemingway writes to Max Perkins at one moment saying, none of these reviews count until I hear what Doss has to say. And it went back and forth between the two. So they formed this literary collegial relationship as kind of revolutionaries who together wanted to change writing and literature because of what the Great War had said, had done. And a lot of you think, well, Dos Passos isn't remembered. That's true. But if you look at the Cubists, we all can identify Picasso, but we kind of forget some of the other names that might be underneath. This is the same thing. All of these writers were affected by the sense of trying to redo just the language itself, not just the topics. And the central partnership was Dos Passos and Hemingway, because they had both experienced from the war that others had not. The next war shows up, which we're talking about, the Spanish Civil War that breaks open in 1937, when the legitimately elected Republican government, small r Republican government of Spain, is trying to be toppled by Franco. And so Hemingway and Dos Passos have this great reunion together. All of this rivalry is put aside because they're going to go to Spain to make a propaganda film to help the Republican government. When Dos Passos arrives, he finds that his dearest friend from his teenage years, Robles, who would also translate his books, have been summarily executed by communists, participating in the fight to save the Republican government. And Dos Passos had begun to fall away as a fellow traveler of communism because of learning about the Stalin purges. But at the same time, here was his best friend who'd been executed for apparently no reason. So when he approaches Hemingway, whom he regards as best friend, and says, my friend Robles was killed. Hemingway says, yeah, well, these things happen in war. I mean, I'm paraphrasing him, but you can find the true comments in the book. Furthermore, he's worried because Dos Passos is digging away, and anything he might find about the Republican government could be an embarrassment. So he doesn't want him digging away. But we also have to bring sex back into this. See, Hemingway at this moment is now not hanging out with Hadley's divorce, not hanging out with his second wife, Pauline, but hanging out with Martha Gellhorn. So when the three of them are there, Hemingway, Martha Gellhorn, and Dos Passos, and Hemingway looks at Dos Passos, who does he see? The man who's married to Kate Smith, who knows Hadley, knows Pauline, who's been with them all along. It creates, shall we say, an awkward tension among them. So this is the final straw, like adolescence, that got to this vicious fight. And again, I don't use this book in the word in the book, but it's a perfect book. The bromance comes to an end. And it's a vicious end. And so this is 1937. And Hemingway lives on to 61, Dos Passos to 70. They make these furtive attempts, and they're very sweet. I mean, Kate Dos Passos writes to Pauline saying, you know, these guys have been such good friends. Can't they get back? I mean, all these efforts, they meet briefly in Havana for one short drink. A number of things happen, but the friendship is never restored. And it ends with this. So the point of all this exploration, why I ended up writing a book about Ernest Hemingway and John Dos Passos, it turned out to be a book that had actually three characters. It had John Dos Passos and Hemingway, but their works. And one of the things I discovered about their works, remember how I represent Dos Passos as this anti-war writer, Hemingway is much more artistic, wanting to represent the reality of war and the manliness and all that. These books were being published, and they were being read by the young men and women who would eventually be embroiled in World War II. So the second great war of the century was for them, introduced to them by literature about the first war. So the marketplace competition of these ideas ends up, I think, being very important, particularly since whose view ends up in the century of war being the lost view, which is Dos Passos's, and whose view prevails. The Great War and the damage it left on its survivors in the pursuit of an appropriate literary response were a key part of the artistic lives of Dos Passos and Hemingway. These novelists who afterwards wrote about the war underscored its disjunctive role, wrote Malcolm Cowley, an ambulance driver who, of course, became a famous critic. War changed men in such a way that they could never be made whole. War's lasting effect on Hemingway and Dos Passos distinguished them from other members of the Lost Generation. It forged their friendship, but in the end, another war took it from them. Sadly, this kind of loss was one of the unchanging tragic aspects of Hemingway's life. Whether it was fame, money, his mother, or shell shock that would be blamed, Hemingway destroyed every friendship, every love affair, and ultimately himself. In 1949, Hemingway sent Dos Passos a report from Italy. This is 22 years after the friendship. That he'd been studying the life of Dante. Seems to be one of the worst jerks that ever lived, but how well he could write, Hem wrote to Dos. This may be a lesson to us all. So that's the tale of my book. Thank you very much for your attention. Nonfiction, you find all the notes telling me where I dug this stuff up. But Dos Passos serves as a perfect literary foil, just like in a novel, where, you know, you learn a lot about Hemingway through Dos Passos' eyes and vice versa. So they work really well together. And I just love the fact that Packer noticed that he was the missing one of that group. So, questions?
Yes. Question. Did you say Fitzgerald was not at the war?
He didn't actually go to the war. He was in a training camp to go. Okay. And there's a very revealing letter in the book where Hemingway writes to Fitzgerald and says, of all of us, Dos Passos was really the one that saw the war. Now, you know, he's wounded and all that, but his exposure to the war is very quick. And there is a difference between receiving the wounds and being nursed than, you know, the kind of horrors that... I mean, one moment Dos Passos, he's such a reflective guy, he's eating a sandwich, and he's realizing he's eating a sandwich basically next to the operating room, you know, where, I mean, this is the kind of thing, if you know more humor, or being an ambulance driver, or news reporter, you begin to get used to the kind of thing. That's why they were different, I think, in some respects. Yes?
Well, what eventually happened to Dos Passos? Did he live a better life?
Yes and no.
His great love affair with Kate Smith came to a very sad end in 1947. They lived in Provincetown, and they were leaving Cape Cod, heading west on Route 28, and the sun was setting, and he got sun blindness and drifted to the right, and the car went right into the back of the pickup truck. She was killed instantly. He lost his right eye. They had never had children. She had a lot of miscarriages, and a few years later, he was in New York working on a novel, and the editor said, as editors often do, this really sucks, you need to get organized. So-and-so can help you. So he spent a weekend with this wonderful woman, Mary. I'm sorry, I had to look up her last name. And it was an intensive editing session. They got all fixed up. And at the end of the weekend, he reached across the table and held her hand and said, should we make plans now? That's the extent of the proposal. They had a child, and Lucy Coggins is the daughter who lives in Virginia. And they have a grandson named John Dos Passos. I mean, she has a son. His grandson, John Dos Passos Coggins, has created the Dos Passos Society. So he did have a second wonderful relationship that gave him a lot of happiness. As you know, Hemingway went downhill from then on in many ways. The devils that beset him. But the pain of the separation and the friendship went on and on. When Movable Feast is published, which is published posthumously, it's like a revenge list. I mean, it's like Hemingway taking hot shots at everyone, including Dos Passos, who appears as the pilot fish. So if you know the pilot fish in Movable Feast, it's a really damning portrayal of Dos Passos. And he's really hurt by this. And in one moment, he's in a church somewhere in New England. And I think it might have been the anniversary of Hemingway's suicide. I don't know what the occasion was, but the priest began to speak about Hemingway. And Dos Passos, who really was a sweet, I mean, everybody loved him. He was a sweet, nice guy. He was so upset he left the church. So it was a wound that never healed for him. Now, the other question about Dos Passos is what happened to his left-wingness? And I was always puzzled by this as an unrepentant left-winger. I didn't like Dos Passos because he went to the other side, supported Goldwater, wrote for the National Review, and did all these awful things. Sorry, I'm sure some of you deliberately, but anyway, folk on number 64 today. But I learned something in writing about him. And I want to find it. It's an extraordinary explanation from Dos Passos. He's dear friends with an American screenwriter named Jack Lawson, whom he met on Chicago. That's the ship that took him to Europe. And they both set out with the sense of, I want to see the war. I want to change the world. They're both small-c communists, left-wingers, etc. Now Dos Passos has seen the Stalin purges. He's seen what happened to Robles. He's beginning to move to the right. And sometimes we think of the right and left as arms extended, but in many respects, in this case, it's like arms this way with a small gap between the two. So Dos Passos is jumping from one to the other as opposed to making his way across. And he's explaining to Jack Lawson why this change, and I think it's a profound comment he makes. Dear Jack, Dos Passos wrote, you must have patience with the unbelievers. The real difference between your attitude and mine about politics is that you think the ends justify the means, and I think all you have in politics and means, the ends are always illusionary. Mm-hmm. And for me, that was a moment in which I got it. And I suddenly felt warm to the later Dos Passos and would have loved to have met him. So that's the other thing that happened to us. Yes, other questions?
Well, I had one sort of lateral question. Did they ever, did Dos Passos ever meet Robert Graves or Siegfried Sassoon or any of those First World War British writers who were left wing?
There's no correspondence that I ran across, but I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, it's a very small world. Yes, yeah, I say that. I'm 90% sure he did. The British experience is so fundamentally different that in many ways I tried to stay away from it because, you know, we lost very few men in comparison. I mean, a whole generation lay dead on the battlefield. I used to show my students a picture of World War II leadership, and I'd say to them, why do you think all these people are so old? Because the entire generation was lost. And that's why the leaders were all these old folks. So for them, it was fundamentally different. But he did publish, Dos Passos published his first of the anti-war novels in London first. They were the most receptive to it, even when it went badly. So I can't answer the question for sure whether he met him or not, but they or hung out with him or whatever, but I don't remember any correspondence.
Yes.
Hemingway stayed close to the movies.
I'm sorry, say that again?
Ernest Hemingway stayed close to the movies, as did Dos Passos, no?
Yeah, you mean watched a lot of movies, or?
No, stayed close to Sarah and Gerald Murphy.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry, you know, my hearing, my world is a world of malapropisms, so I interpreted Murphy's as movies, you see. They did.
And I was just wondering if the Murphy's, because they were so
they liked Dos Passos more than
they loved him and Peggy, yeah. But did they ever try to create a rapprochement or anything like that?
I don't know of any evidence. If they did, they didn't do it in the letter. They were distraught. I mean,
yeah.
Sarah Murphy writes about the end of the friendship regularly. Mm. I suspect they might have tried to do something.
Yeah.
It's clear if you read their letters that they liked Doss better than Hemingway.
Mm-hmm.
And they did these things where they would send Hemingway a check as well as Dos Passos, even though Hemingway at this point didn't need it, as a way of kind of being fair, you know, like your children, you want to give them the same amount of money.
Yes.
And I think one of the reasons that that Gerald and Dos Passos got along is they both had artistic sides to them. I mean, you know, you saw the watercolor. Dos Passos was always painting, so they had a way of communicating that was different. Also, the Murphys saw a lot of the horrible stuff that went on in Hemingway's life. There's a scene in my book where Hadley decides to be Machiavellian and bring Pauline into the group. You know, the idea you want to have your enemies in your cabinet at this point. And they're down in the Mediterranean hanging out with the Murphys. And Hemingway's thrilled. I mean, this is, if you've read the letters, he thinks, you know, he may have his ménage à trois, just hold everything just this way. Well, it's very revealing about Pauline, and I don't mean that she's also got some nice characteristics, but one of the things she makes sure she does is she sunbathes in the nude, because she doesn't have stretch marks. So, you know, the Murphys are watching all of this. So I think, you know, and they love Kate Smith. So I think if they had a favorite literary child, it would have been Dos Passos.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Reading the book, I found it almost to have a dynamic novelistic structure and drive to it. Yeah, this
development.
You're talking about my work?
Yeah. Oh, thank
you. This development. did you have a strong sense of that as you wrote it, or
well,
did it just naturally come?
I was kind of purposeful in that one of the things I talked my editor into is no chapter titles. I said, if this is going to be like a novel, I don't want to have, you know, Paris or They Come Together or all those, you know, dreadful kind of chapter titles. I thought I'm writing about two writers. I wanted to write it in a novelistic fashion. But trust me, there are no made-up comments. I mean, you can go to the end notes and find these things. And I thought their friendship created such moments of tension that, I'm a believer in narrative nonfiction. I go every year to the Mayborn Conference, which is like the tribe of nonfiction writers. And the theory here is if you steal all of the best techniques of novelists without making anything up.
Mm-hmm.
So you can use foreshadowing, you can use tension, you can use literary foils, as long as you don't transgress a certain line. So I had one book in which this guy shoots his wife later in life, and when I found that he picked up a gun and chased after a suitor of his previous girlfriend, I thought, you know, of all of the elements I could pick out of his youth, I put that in. Why? Because I thought that would be a little bit of foreshadowing. That's what we do. We select our facts in that way. So I'm very pleased you said that. That was purposeful. So I think we're going to all pass out from the heating. So oh, one more question.
I'm sorry. Yeah. What is the, it seems like so famous, the Hemingway cruelty to Fitzgerald?
The Hemingway and what? Well, you know, it's wandering a little far from my field. What I ran across is, of course, the famous story in which they discuss the size of certain aspects of their anatomy. Let me put it this way. When I finished my book and Patty, my wife, read it, she liked Hemingway better than Dos Passos, whereas it's clear you, if you listen to me, Gus Fawcett is my guy. And I think one of the reasons is that as a writer, and particularly biography, you develop enormous empathy for your characters. And I realize that Hemingway is this deeply wounded character. Today we describe him as having issues. In that his cruelty towards others is not the same as somebody who sees a bug and goes out of their way to squish them. His mother, I mean, for instance, you do know his mother sent him the gun that his father had used in his life. I mean, that alone would be enough. So what I got at is that I felt that a lot of Hemingway's cruelties towards Fitzgerald, all of the people he pushed away, everybody who loved him he pushed away ultimately, was a devil inside him as opposed to a purposeful meanness. And I think that's why Patty in the end thought, she got him more and felt that those passages remained too cerebral and too unemotional. Well, you guys have really been delightful to survive with me and hear me talk this long. So thanks very much for being here.